The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfold, Judge Bjorkman, and Judge Harris. The Honorable Diane B. Bratfold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is May 29th, 2025. And we have five matters on our calendar today. Three of those will be argued orally. And I see the lawyers are here for the first case. So, Marshall, will you call the first case, please? And I'll make a few additional remarks.
Calling A250239, State of Minnesota Appellant versus Troy Lee Rohrman Respondent.
All right. And, counsel, I'll say a few things that you may well be aware of, but just to remind you, when you approach the podium and get settled in, do whatever you need to have your materials about you, and make sure to do what I just did, have the microphone pointed toward your mouth. Here's what we're trying to do is have a clear oral record of today's proceedings. You're probably aware that there is a live stream that is made available of today's argument, but the audio recording is what we maintain as our record on our website. And then I'd ask you, before you start your argument, to identify yourself as well as your client clearly, and then to keep an eye on the clock. We really enjoy our conversation with you today and hearing from both of you and all the attorneys in the case. Having said that, the time just tends to go quickly. So, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you when you are.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew Draper. I am the city prosecutor for Maple Grove. I represent the state of Minnesota. Today we're here before the court respectfully requesting this court reverse the district court's pretrial dismissal of the complaint and remand it back to the trial court. The state's requesting this court reverse that dismissal for two reasons. The first is that there was plain error in the factual determination, as the court did not do a full consideration of all the facts and circumstances of this particular case. Rather, there was only a review of the separate felony cases pleadings. The second reason is the district court did not properly apply the law to the particular facts of this case. The district court dismissed the state's complaint pursuant to Minnesota Statute 609.035. No written order was filed, and the court's oral analysis substantially deviated from the precedent that this court has set in the cases such as Bookwalter, Bishop, Heath, Fleck. And so while the state bears the burden to show that the defendant's offenses were not part of a single behavioral incident, at the trial court, the district court did not allow us to submit briefs, which is common practice in our jurisdiction. Additionally, we were not very...
Well, there had been a written motion filed, right, to which the state didn't respond?
Correct. And generally, procedurally, this was set for a settlement conference, and at those conferences, we asked to submit briefs. That was not done. And then in terms of proceeding then to argument, as you can see in the transcript, we tried to start citing case law, and we were quickly shut down and just basically said, you can appeal my dismissal. And so while we have that burden, the preponderance of evidence to show that it was not a single behavioral incident, we were not really afforded the opportunity to make argument. And so I understand that there could be, we didn't object at that time, and I would suggest that that was plain error. However, we're before the court today because I believe for judicial economy that it would just be best to address whether or not 609.035 applies to this case in this specific particular set of circumstances. And so with this, there needs to be, the clear error standard for the factual determination and de novo as to the application of the law. And so a factual determination is clearly erroneous if it's not supported by the record. And I believe that's in a Heath case, who then cites within it the Wasson case. And so the court only considered the statement of probable cause in the felony complaint and then the factual basis of the plea colloquy in the felony case. And even looking there, it's clear that these are separate behavioral incidents. And I'll cite a couple places within the addendum and within those transcripts that I believe will be good to note when doing this review. Addendum number 5 is the hearing of, or the transcript of the hearing for the motion to dismiss in this case. And on page 8, lines 2 through 23, is where the court does a short analysis for their determination of their dismissal. I would note in there, basically, the court just said, I read the transcript, the May 20th text, or May 20th conversation is the May 30th conversation. And that's not specific of what they said, but...
What was the significance of the reference to the May 20th phone call or phone calls? I was unclear if it was one or three calls from the jail. But so what's the significance of including that in the factual basis for the guilty plea?
I don't know. And the public defender is the one that did the factual basis, and they just included that in there. But it wasn't within the probable cause statement that the state charged, nor was in the complaint, if you look at the four counts, was anything regarding May 20th mentioned. It wasn't within the date range. And then when you look at the different parts of the substance of what the charge was, they all specifically charge May 30th. So I don't know.
You're suggesting it's just background rather than something that should lead the court to conclude that the respondent was actually pleading guilty to something that happened on May 20th.
Correct. And I would suggest as well, when you look at the probable cause statement in the felony, there is, you know, Spriegel evidence, and then additionally there is similar domestic evidence that a lot of the times prosecutors will put in there when noting later on for bail arguments. And if you look at the bottom of the felony complaint, there is a mention basically of previous contacts, previous violations for the court's consideration for a bail determination. And so I would suggest or note to the court that it's more appropriate to rely on what was actually charged and the dates that were actually charged rather than one mention in a factual basis during a plea colloquy. And I think it's also important to point out in the Bishop case that the court's not bound by the factual basis in a guilty plea. And I think that's a really good analogous case to where we are, because in that case, there was a driving after cancellation and then a separate driving under the influence charge. And those were separated only by about 3 hours. And when they were going through in that case, it was charged under two different charging documents. It was pled, basically, the plea petition had them pled together, but said, we're going to plead to this case, and then later we're going to plead to the DWI case. After they pled to the driving after cancellation, the DWI was mentioned in that plea petition. They subsequently moved to dismiss the DWI because it was mentioned in the plea petition for the driving after cancellation. And this court found that just because it's mentioned in those pleadings does not create a single behavioral incident. I would also note in addendum 3, it's the transcript of the felony plea. Page 3, line 3, is when all of the cases get called. And I would note there were two felony cases called, but then this case, 27 CR 23 11479, was also called. And so it was called separately. On page 4, lines 9 through 11, when the court asked, what is the plea agreement? They said, we are going to dismiss one felony case. It's going to be a plea to this felony case, and we're going to dismiss counts 3 and 4. It was silent as to this separate misdemeanor charge on 27 CR 23-11479. And I would submit to this court, because it wasn't addressed, and if, in, I know in a respondent's brief, they had said, well, the felony court, the county attorney, counts 3 and 4 were these charges. If that were the case, then the felony prosecutor would have had an obligation to note that to the court, to say, this separate charging document, this separate misdemeanor case that was just called, we actually charged that in our felony complaint, so that also needs to be dismissed. But that wasn't done because this, again, I would submit to the court, is a separate behavioral incident. It's a separate case. And so from a factual consideration, I do believe the district court did have clear error in their analysis of the facts. And I would also point out that this court has held with longstanding precedent that the test basically for looking at 609.035 is not a mechanical. It involves an examination of all of the facts and circumstances of the trial court. And so just looking at two pleadings and saying, well, they mentioned it there, I don't think that's a sufficient review of the facts and circumstances of each particular case as is set in the Bookwalter case. And then when you look also, at the second point, the de novo review of the law, it's quite clear. Both I cited Heath. I believe Judge Bratbold, you were on a recent panel in the Boswell case that came out in April. And unfortunately, you relied on Backen where I relied on Heath, but the substance of the two are the same. There's a three-pronged basic test of determinations of time, place, and single behavioral incident or similar focus of what the defendant's conduct is. And so when you look at time, place, and single criminal objective, a lot of the times this court has gone through each and kind of addressed them separately. So time, May 20th and May 30th are separated by 10 days. It's obviously a longer period of time. Traditionally, when you have these types of cases, they're separated by maybe days or hours, and so that's generally the analysis that the court has. But with the 10 days, that's why I cited Fleck, is because when the instances become separated by a significant period of time, those motivations become more separable. And so I think in terms of the time of both of these offenses, that's in the state's or the appellate's favor of that these are not a single behavioral incident. When you look at the place determination, that again works in the favor of the appellant or the state in the fact that the three initial calls that were made to the victim in this case were made from the Hennepin County Jail. He was subsequently released, and then 10 days went by. And actually, I don't know if anybody knows where he was when he was sending these texts. At one point, he was in Monticello. At one point, he was arrested in Fridley. But the common place or the common denominator is where the victim was living at the time. And so it was charged in Maple Grove because the text messages were received in that common place. But the defendant's place, he was obviously not in jail while he was sending text messages, and there was an allegation that he admitted to during his plea that he was drinking, and I don't believe they serve alcohol in the jail, so I think that's pretty good evidence that he was not incarcerated at the time. So for the place considerations, it is obvious as well that he was not in the same place. And then it's the analysis of, is this a single criminal objective? And the court has set some pretty significant precedent that broad statements of criminal purpose do not unify separate acts into a single course of conduct. And so there's in that Boswell case, and I did a letter stating that that's going to be an additional citation. The Boswell case does a really good job of explaining common criminal objectives and single criminal objectives and how those two are distinct. And so while there may be a broad criminal objective of having the victim change their testimony, the single objective of each is different. And so, for instance, the witness tampering charge that was from the May 20th, the single objective that he was trying to say, I'll buy you computers and or I will expose your employer's cigarette purchasing illegal activities, that was to influence testimony basically by offering some sort of influence of a computer. But it wasn't a threat of injury or it wasn't actual force. Whereas on May 30th, and when you look at the charge of the tampering with the witness for the felony count, the essential elements for that are if force was used or threat of injury to person and property. And so the May 20th did not have a threat of injury or personal property. And so those are distinguished in what the single or the single criminal objective was. The single criminal objective on May 20th was to influence by personal gain or not being exposed to criminal liability, whereas on May 30th, those text messages, those were by force, and the intent there, the single objective, was to change testimony by threat of force.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, I just want to ask a little bit more about how you're analyzing a single criminal objective. It seems to me you're emphasizing, in your remarks, emphasizing the difference between the 520 phone calls and the texts on 530, that what you're really looking at are, in part, the elements of the offense and the manner in which the offense was committed, as opposed to the objective. Does that question make sense to you? If it does, go ahead and respond. I don't see how the way in which the offense occurred is the same as the objective. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the case law on that. So help me out.
And I think that the Johnson case does a good job of explaining you have to look at the conduct almost to analyze the intent. And I think that those two things are intertwined, of the objective of what they're trying to do in that specific incident or that specific circumstance in case, and then an overall broad objective. And I believe that it was Bookwalter, when it was the methamphetamine cases of manufacturing and then possession with the intent. And they had said, well, there's a broad criminal objective here of manufacturing and selling methamphetamine. However, when you dissect kind of what the specific elements of that crime were and the singularity at those specific times of what the defendant's intent was, it does separate them from being a common objective to a single objective. Does that answer your question?
It's helpful. Thank you, counsel.
Yes. And I have 20 seconds left, so at that, if there are no more questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Right. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Mr. Rohrman this morning. Mr. Rohrman is a military veteran who suffers from mental illness, including PTSD, depression, and anxiety that has manifested itself into substance abuse and criminal conduct. During the two-week period in May of 2023, Mr. Rohrman was struggling, drinking excessively, and took part in conduct that resulted in criminal charges being filed against him. Mr. Rohrman thought that by taking responsibility for his actions, pleading guilty to two felony counts, admitting to his conduct on May 20th and May 30th, and taking part in the Veterans Restorative Justice Program, he could move on with his life and obtain the mental health treatment he needed and the substance abuse treatment he needed. But the state, for unknown reasons, has continued to pursue criminal charges for the identical conduct that Mr. Rohrman pleaded guilty to under oath when he pled guilty to the felony offenses. And I can report that while Mr. Rohrman is doing well on probation, the state's decision to pursue these charges has created more anxiety and has gotten in the way of his treatment. We are requesting that this court dismiss the state's appeal or affirm the district court's order. Dismissal is warranted because the state has already successfully prosecuted Mr. Rohrman for a felony count of witness tampering for his conduct.
It seems to me, I just want to stop you because it seems to me, I don't know if you're putting the cart before the horse or if you're conflating sort of the merits of the argument, but boy, it seems like our case law is pretty clear that if a district court dismisses all charges, that would be a critical impact that would allow the state to have take an appeal. Why am I wrong about that?
I think generally speaking, I would agree with that, but this is a very unique case in that the state negotiated a plea guilty to a felony, to two felonies,
right,
for his conduct.
Based on conduct on May 30th, right? As I look at the felony or the complaint that includes the felony charges, which also includes two misdemeanor charges, they are all based on conduct that occurred on or around May 30th, 2023, correct?
That's what, in the counts, that's what's listed, but in the probable cause section, it mentions the phone calls that were made on May 20th from the head of the county jail.
Well, it also mentions when he was served with the OFP.
That's correct. But he also, and I think is the most important, and I want to kind of pivot from what the state's been arguing, our entire argument is premised on the idea that Mr. Warman admitted to facts of what he did on May 20th as part of his guilty plea.
So he pleaded guilty to these charges from Maple Grove, in your assessment, when he entered his guilty plea in the felony matter?
He didn't plead guilty to them, but he pleaded guilty to facts that were part of the same behavioral incident as the Maple Grove charges. So the analysis is not whether the May 20th and the May 30th conduct are part of the same behavioral incident. The question is whether the May 20th phone calls that he pleaded guilty to making in the felony matter are part of the same behavioral incident as the Maple Grove charges. The state's entire analysis, I'm not even arguing that. That's not our position. Our position is that when he pleaded guilty as part of the factual basis to the witness tampering, he admitted to making phone calls and attempting to dissuade the witness from testifying. That happened on May 20th.
So he's already pled guilty to and has been punished for the conduct asserted in the Maple Grove case.
That's right. Okay. He pleaded guilty to facts that are identical facts to the Maple Grove charges. And that's where the analysis ends.
Because why don't we look at the case law regarding what's the same behavioral incident, counsel? I'm not following you on that.
Yeah, so you do, but you do it for whether the May 20th phone calls in the felony, a guilty plea, were part of the same behavioral incident as the May 20th phone calls that he made in the Maple Grove case. That's the analysis. So are those phone calls part of the same behavioral incident? Yes, because they're the same phone calls. And they're the same objective because they're both felony witness tampering. And the same objective because he's making a phone call to someone to tamper knowing that there was an order for protection in place. So the question is whether identical phone calls are part of the same behavioral incident. Not whether a phone calls on May 20th and text messages on May 30th are part of the same behavioral incident. That's irrelevant to the analysis.
So is there any case law that does a similar analysis, counsel?
That says if you plead guilty in one case and admit facts as part of a guilty plea on one date, that's the same behavioral incident for another case?
Right.
There's nothing on point because this never happens. The state would never pursue anything like this except for in this case. There's no purpose in this. Mr. Rohrman.
The trouble I'm having with your argument, counsel, is that by simply acknowledging that facts exist, such as I was served with an OFP on May 19th and I made these calls on May 20th, your client was not subject to criminal liability for the calls on May 20th in this particular case. And so the guilty plea, I don't understand how it would involve liability to which he was not subject in that case.
2 points. One, if I could just read you that plea conversation. It's very short, and it's not just a mention of the phone call. So on page 13, attorney asks, so Mr. Rohrman, I'm going to ask you a question. After they discussed the stalking, the facts supporting the stalking conviction, they then go to the felony witness tampering. So Mr. Rohrman, I'm going to ask questions now about the second count you are pleading guilty to, witness tampering. Yes. RB, you'd agree, was a potential witness in a trial against you. Is that right? Yes. You intentionally attempted to dissuade the victim from attending or testifying at this trial. Is that correct? Yes. You did this first while you were in custody, calling her and telling her that you would hope she wouldn't participate in this case. Correct? Yes. That is a guilty plea. That is admitting to facts supporting elements of the offense. I understand it's not part listed within the charge document under the offense, but it is in the probable cause section. This was a negotiated plea deal between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and Mr. Rohrman to plead guilty to two felonies. As part of that factual basis, he admitted not just that he made these calls, but that they were part of the offense. And then the state agreed to that factual basis. The district court then accepted that factual basis and moved on. That is part of this case. So the question then becomes, are the phone calls on May 20th, the identical phone calls, are they all part of the same behavioral incident? Absolutely they are. And the state should not be able to then prosecute him after admitting under oath that he committed these crimes. That is what 609.035 is designed to protect against, is when you negotiate a plea, you admit to facts, you're punished for those facts, you're put on probation for 3 years, that then you're not going to get prosecuted for the identical conduct in a misdemeanor charge. And that's what happened in this case.
So, counsel, why, you know, of course, there's a lot of variety in plea transcripts laying factual basis. They tend to be fairly tight, but they do occasionally touch on related facts that are not necessarily part or necessary to the factual basis for the offense to which the defendant is pleading guilty. Why isn't that what happened? I mean, really, it's a matter of a four-line reference, most of which were words uttered by the attorney and not by Mr. Rohrman, but I acknowledge it was a flat-out admission, of course, by Mr. Rohrman. But why isn't that just what happened here?
I mean, every guilty plea looks exactly like this, where the attorney asks questions, asks specific details.
I guess the reason I'm pushing back is because this 520 incident is in no way necessary or even sufficient for the felony offense, right? Because there is no, I mean, this is an argument made by appellant's counsel, there is no threat involved that is sufficient to get to the first degree offense. I believe it's first degree, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's correct. But when you negotiate a plea deal and the state agrees to, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office agrees to a plea deal and they agree to the facts to support that plea deal and a defendant admits under oath to facts in the colloquy for the actual guilty plea, not just a general conversation, right? This is specific to that count. It is specific answers to facts that support a witness tampering offense, right? It's not just you were served with an order for protection, you made phone calls, and then 10 days later you did this. It is specifically asking, you did this to dissuade her from attending or testifying at this trial. You did this while you were in custody. All about witness tampering. It's not just irrelevant facts. It goes directly to the heart of it. And now we're going to allow the Maple Grove City Attorney's Office to pursue misdemeanor charges. And it's also really important that the identical charges from a different date on May 30th were dismissed. So the state of Minnesota, I think it's also really important to understand, we are talking about the state of Minnesota, the executive branch, punishing my client, deciding to then dismiss two charges, and now the state wants to then prosecute him for the exact same charges. That doesn't make any sense. Why would the Hennepin County Attorney's Office dismiss those two misdemeanor charges, and then now we can allow the same state of Minnesota to pursue prosecution for those same two charges?
Again, that requires us to sort of assume the unity of time and place, right? I mean, we're talking about stuff that happened on May 20th and May 30th, but I'm looking back again at the plea hearing, and I mean, it's you say there was an agreement to dismiss, but I mean, the transcript makes it clear there were only two files that were being resolved. I mean, it specifically references the Maple Grove misdemeanor complaint that flows from the May 20th phone calls as being pending but not part of this plea agreement. So I'm really struggling when you say it was clear this was part of a plea agreement when that doesn't seem to be reflected in the hearing transcript.
A couple of things to clarify. I'm not saying part of the agreement was that the Maple Grove city attorney would dismiss the charges. I'm not saying that's in the record anywhere. I'm saying that the facts he admitted to establish that he was also pleading guilty to his conduct on May 20th, and under 609.035, that should have been dismissed. So I just want to be clear about the record. So there are two felony cases. The first felony case is what created the OFP. I believe it was on May 17th he was charged with a domestic assault and some terroristic threats of violence, and that resulted in him getting the order for protection. Then he goes into jail. He makes these phone calls. And then the text messages on the 30th, and as part of this plea deal, they dismissed the May 17th felony offenses. So that's what that is. Our position is that this just went under the radar, and it wasn't part of the plea agreement, but as part of the factual basis, it was agreed to that he would admit to making the phone calls on May 20th because that's what he admitted to. And that's also, and the state accepted that factual basis, and the court accepted that factual basis. So I think it's a real slippery slope if we're going to allow for city attorney's offices to pursue misdemeanor offenses based on the same conduct a defendant just gave up all of his constitutional rights to defend against in pleading guilty to a more serious offense, And then also the state did dismiss misdemeanor charges that would have, you know, they're the identical misdemeanor charges. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we urge this court to dismiss this appeal or to affirm the district court's order. Like I said, Mr. Rohrman believed that this guilty plea would get rid of the charges, he could move on, he would be on probation, and he would have two felony counts hanging over his head if he violated his probation. And if this court were to reverse and it goes back, it would do nothing to assist Mr. Rohrman. It would do nothing to assist anything in the system because this is the exact same victim. It's the exact same order for protection. There's nothing that anybody would gain by allowing the state to pursue a subsequent prosecution of Mr. Rohrman for his identical conduct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So, Mr. Draper, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I'll just point out two things. Just the plain meaning of identical is the same in every aspect and regard. And the charges in the felony case specifically are for May 30th for text messages. Counts 3 and 4 are for text messages.
On or about May 30th? So it's not necessarily just the text messages. It says on or about, so it seems to me that the respondent is arguing, and I'd like you to address this, that he agreed to plead guilty to the first degree tampering. As part of that, he specifically laid a factual basis in which this May 20th fact was admitted to. The state, I would say, tacitly agreed, as they didn't point anything out. The court agreed. And now it seems that he is being charged for, again, conduct that he may have already admitted to. Why isn't this the very conduct that we want to dissuade as it relates to the statute and the same behavioral incident?
Thank you, Judge. Well, I think it's first important to point out the dates of charging. So it's not as if he entered that factual basis and subsequently the city decided, well, you admitted to this, we're now going to charge you. I signed that complaint 3 hours after the county attorney signs the complaint, and there was no, you know, conspiracy to do so separately. It was just the manner of which those charges were submitted to our respective agencies. And so I would point back again to that Bishop case, where a factual basis was laid for one charge, the driving after cancellation, that mentioned that DWI, but then the court held that that did not create that single behavioral incident. And I think that that is really important when you look at this case. And I would almost pose a hypothetical, I guess, back to the court, because within the probable cause statement, there's also a mention of a May 26th order for protection violation, as well as a witness tampering account that occurred in Monticello, which would be Wright County. And so respondent's argument is, well, the state of Minnesota under this umbrella got a conviction for conduct, so why are you trying to charge any other conduct that was, you know, around that similar time? And if Wright County, this wasn't reported to Wright County, but hypothetically, if Wright County were to have said, you committed an order for protection violation in Monticello, at that same time, you witness tampered in Monticello, we as Wright County are going to charge you for the conduct that you did in our county. If he would have pled in Hennepin, would that rob Wright County of their jurisdiction over a May 26th in-person meeting? And I would submit to the court, I don't believe that that would hold a lot of weight. I think Wright County is independent of Hennepin County, and they would be able to proceed forward with their charges. I also think that with the mention that these were identical charges is a little bit of a misnomer. Identical is not a different day. It's not done by a different mechanism, and it's not done by different conduct. I think the court keenly points out that while saying that he was charged with identical and that the conduct on May 20th could or was sufficient for the felony count, It's not. Offering pecuniary gain or telling someone that I'm going to tell law enforcement so you get arrested is not a first-degree felony witness.
And I don't hear that argument from Respondent's counsel that the 520 text messages, the phone calls were sufficient to prove the first degree. I mean, what I hear counsel saying is that that was part of the factual basis and that effectively Mr. Roman, he did in fact admit to what happened on 520.
And I may have been mistaken what I heard. I just heard they were identical and that the factual basis lay.
And you don't disagree that the, you know, so let's pretend this case went to trial instead, the first degree witness tampering. And that's not your case, but just assume that. I mean, the evidence of the 520 phone calls would have been relevant, at least. We don't know whether it would have been admitted or not, but it would have been relevant, right?
I believe it would have been relevant, and I believe I left my, it's in my brief, and off the top of my head, I'm having trouble citing, I think it's 629, but it's similar fact evidence from domestics that allow the state to present relevant prior acts of domestic abuse, which do count, and my time is up. May I finish my argument or my last point? Yeah. It does allow, similar to Spriegel, prior evidence of domestic conduct, which would have been this OFP violation. And so the state, if it went to trial, would have been able to mention May 20th without it actually prosecuting May 20th under that statute.
Any other questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. This matter is well briefed, well argued. It's now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeline. Thank you so much.